Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. When we think of queer activism in history, we think of places like San Francisco and New York. We think of the Stonewall Riots and Castro Street. But Minnesota and the Twin Cities have their own unique and fascinating queer history that's just as worthy of being looked at as anywhere else. And now, while one episode is not nearly enough time, on this episode of Real College Podcast, in fact, my last episode of Real College Podcast, we're diving in and taking a glimpse at the fascinating, unique queer history of Minnesota. We've got writers, beaches, music, and more here on Real College Podcast. As American society has grown more accepting of queer identities, we've seen more and more representation of queer people in our media. But this representation wasn't always there and didn't just happen. It was fought for. Nathan Fervoy has more.
If you turn on your TV today, it's likely after flipping through a few channels that you'll find a character or two outside the straight white demographic. While it's easy to take this for granted, it's important to recognize that it was only a matter of years ago that this was not the case. In the push for cultural acceptance of diversity in America, media, highlighting the stories of marginalized groups, plays a major role. To get where we sit now, many individuals had to fight to define themselves in the face of a dominating straight white narrative. Judith Katz is one such individual.
My name is Judith Katz, and my position here at the university is I'm one of the departmental advisors for the English department and the departmental advisor for gender, women, and sexuality studies. I'm also a novelist. I have two published novels, Running Fiercely Toward a High Thin Sound and The Escape Artist. And within the past couple of years, both of them have been republished by Bywater Books. So, yeah. And I've been working here at the university in one form or another since the 80s. I used to teach in gender, women, and sexuality studies back when it was called women's studies. And then I've kind of evolved into this advising job.
As a Jewish lesbian author and creative in the 80s and 90s, Katz worked on the forefront of introducing new perspectives to the Midwestern culture. I sat with her to ask how her work differed from her predecessors and how it has influenced younger generations since.
Am I an elder? Yes. Yes, I am an elder. I consider myself an elder. I started my life as a playwright, and like I said, I was here, Foot in the Mountain Theater. I worked in Omaha, Nebraska at a theater called the Omaha Magic Theater, where basically at the Omaha Magic Theater, we were doing like drag junk theater for a long time. My novels, I think, were kind of coming out of that time. I mean, it took me a really long time to write my first novel. I started it in the 80s, I finished it here in 90. It was published in 92 by Firebrand Books the first time. And it's about a Jewish lesbian who doesn't feel comfortable in her lesbian community as a Jew and doesn't feel comfortable in her Jewish community or in her family as a lesbian. And so I think I was part of a group of women writers who were basically telling our stories and finding our voices. I got a lot of permission from other writers at that time. What they were doing was, like Cherie did this thing where she would use a lot of Spanish words and have no glossary. So you can look those words up if you want, was kind of her feeling. So when I was using Yiddish words in my work, it was like, okay, I'm not using a glossary for this. Mm-hmm. You can look those words up. And so she was doing that. Dorothy Allison was writing a lot about her life as a working class, actually poor, Southern lesbian. And her first novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, just kind of blew the roof off of everything. So there, I was writing in a community, and even though it wasn't always a local community, I was still writing in, like, within this cohort of other lesbian writers. We're all about the same age. Many of us are still struggling with our third novels. You know, it's like, so
beyond broadly sharing her story through her writing, Kat's worked to bring more diverse stories into the local Minneapolis scene.
But also, another author who has since moved to Chicago, Barry Jean Borich, and myself, kind of made this lesbian presence at the organization that's now nationally known, called The Loft. But back then, there was kind of this movement on the part of me and Barry and Alex Pate, who's used to teach in Afro-Am here, and David Mira, who's an Asian American author, to kind of try to diversify the culture of the Loft.
Could you talk about what the process of de-stratifying, as you were saying, what was that like? Were there any?
It was like a lot of fights, a lot of arguments, and a lot of processing, and a lot of just kind of being there, and asserting ourselves as being part of the culture. And then, you know, this brings up a whole issue of like, what is cultural diversity, and is being queer like part of cultural diversity? And I think by now, here in the early 2000s, we're kind of getting it that, yep, it definitely is. Mm-hmm. And within that diversity, there's even more diversity. But we would have fights. I think we did our best back then to kind of remind everybody, mm-hmm, that there was like a bigger world than what we then used to think about as the cabin culture here, that like it seemed like when we were doing this work, the big thing here in terms of how writers wrote was supposed to, the Minnesota voice was the cabin. And I think I just saw an article, and it might have been in the Star Tribune, about how the whole Lake Wobegon culture is like, that's not happening anymore, because it's very clear that there are so many diverse and wonderful voices by writers of color, by queer writers of color. What's happened is this place has evolved from someplace where the most important thing that you could do was write about the sense of place, the cabin, the woods, the lake, and now people are like getting a lot of good attention for writing out of their own voices about their culture and their past. And that's true for whether the writer is a queer writer or a writer of color, or, you know, just a cis white writer who's, you know, doing their thing. I feel like that's been a really kind of wonderful, remarkable evolution that's happened here.
Would you say that that kind of scene that you were a part of was reshaping the old like cabin style that you were talking about? Was it like using tropes from that and using them in different ways, or no?
First of all, I'm from the East Coast. The whole cabin culture thing was just baffling to me, and you know, Garrison Keillor baffled me, and you know, I might have found him entertaining at a point in time, but I was baffled. And so, no, I kind of feel like people just started writing about ourselves. It's like, I like going to a cabin. Mm-hmm. I like Lake Superior, but I also like the ocean better. And I'm not really interested in recreating that. I mean, I think what we did was, there's a really wonderful thing that Alex Pate wrote. And he talks about the African-American man gets out of his car in some town, western Minnesota, and like what that was like. And I think it wasn't about using those tropes. It was about ignoring them, actually, to be honest with you.
Since helping to usher in this newer style of writing, Katz has watched as the style has evolved further after being adopted by a multitude of diverse young writers.
The whole idea of what it means to be a writer, I believe, is really evolving and changing. And for somebody like me who's old, trying to kind of figure out now, after having been kind of quiet for a while, how do I kind of step back into this world has been really an interesting and still continues to be an interesting challenge. Mm-hmm. Because things are like great. It's different. It's beautiful and fun. And there's some really exciting stuff happening here. I mean, one of the things that's so funny about this
For Real College podcast, I'm Nathan Fervoy.
As a young queer person, learning queer history has been a bit like falling into Wonderland. I'm amazed at how much queer history just lays hidden in plain sight before us every day. So for my last ever story for the podcast, I wanted to try to go out and make contact with one of those lost, forgotten queer spaces. The story came to me while I was digging through a box of old KFII promotional material. In the box, there was a flyer advertising a get-together at a place called Bear Bottom Beach. Well, actually, it's not called Bear Bottom Beach, but it's actually called I Can't Say on the Air because there's a swear word in it. Anyways, you get the picture. I came across this flyer, and I was like, what is this place? And after doing a quick Google search, I learned that Bear Bottom Beach was an old cruising spot located in the Twin Cities. And cruising, for those of you who don't know, is
when people solicit sex with no money involved in public with each other. That's the most kind of bare bones way you can say it, and it's especially among gay men and bisexual men.
That's Myra Billen-Phibbs, a student at the University of Minnesota who's done oral history research on the cruising scene in the Twin Cities during the 70s and 80s. When I first conceived of this story, I thought it'd be a fun way to try to connect with a queer past that I knew nothing about. And so, after learning about Bear Bottom Beach, I decided I would go out and find it.
I will talk about Bear Bottom Beach, and I want to talk about the fact that there are three places that have been known as Bear Bottom Beach.
As it turned out, not only was I wrong in thinking that there was only one Bear Bottom Beach, but the beach that I knew the most about, a sandy strip along the Mississippi, no longer even existed. The other two, however, were still around, and Myra told me more about them.
The second Bear Bottom Beach was on Twin Lake in Golden Valley, so in the suburbs, but close to town. To get to that beach, you'd have to go through a thicket, like a big piece of woods, and there was a little path that went through. I haven't been there, but I hear that it's going strong, so that's still very much a place. The third one is really short. Hidden Beach on Cedar Lake, which is now like an official city beach, used to have to go through the woods to get there. Now there's a road and a porta potty and it's like an official thing. But it used to be you had to walk through this path that was like as narrow as a person all the way through these woods, and then you would get to the tiny beach there. That historically, until they cleared it out, was a nude beach.
I still wanted to visit Bear Bottom Beach. And even with one taken away by the river, I decided I would visit the two that still existed, even if they weren't what they once were. And so, on one of the first truly beautiful days of spring, me, Nathan, Hannah, and Tosin decided to trek out into the city and find Bear Bottom Beach. We started with Hidden Beach on Cedar Lake.
A dog is having the time of its life.
Since it was beautiful out, the beach was filled with couples, kids, friends, and dogs enjoying the day. But the beach's history as a gay nudist beach was gone. In its place, just as Myra had said, the city had put up picnic tables and cleared away the trees. I knew that the beach had been claimed by the city, but still, actually seeing it made me feel weird. After standing around for a bit, we went back to the car and drove off to the third Bear Bottom Beach. Just as Myra had said, we found a dirt trail leading through the trees that went down to Twin Lake. But along the way, I noticed that there were signs marking the trail. After about 5 minutes wandering through the forest, we finally reached the beach, and just like before, there were people out there enjoying the beautiful day. On one end of the beach, there was a group of aging bikers hugging and cracking open cold drinks. On another end of the beach, a group of teenagers were lounging in hammocks and blasting music. But just like the last speech, it didn't really feel like this was a queer space. It felt like a beach.
The kind of great untold part of the story of downtown Minneapolis is like regeneration or like gentrification. The sexual spaces are curiously left out of all of those histories, but they played a huge role. And that's what I found in my research.
If Bear Bottom Beach has, as I fear, disappeared as a queer space, then it is just another lost queer space within the larger history of the Twin Cities. As me and Myra talked, she told me about how, as part of an effort to rebuild downtown, queer businesses were forced out and destroyed.
The fact that these businesses existed in these spaces, so crucial corner lots on Hennepin, 8th and Hennepin, 7th and Hennepin, 6th and Hennepin, that are now worth millions of dollars, big warehouses that are now worth millions of dollars and are full of restaurants and boutiques and luxury lofts, these spaces in the 60s, 70s, and 80s were occupied by shady, dirty, disreputable, gay public sexual businesses, commercial sex businesses. So we're talking about 3 bathhouses on Hennepin or near Hennepin. We're talking about, I think, 6 or 7 porn bookstores on, I think, 9 blocks in Hennepin, 3 or 4 porn theaters downtown. It took up a lot of the Hennepin Strip. What that did was it drove the property values to nothing. The buildings weren't worth anything because they were all, I mean, what is a bathhouse worth at the end of it? Most of them get either completely gutted or the buildings get destroyed, which is what happened to 315 North First. In 1988, it got bought out by BSR Properties. The developer specifically said, "We're sandblasting the whole building, down to the brick. There's nothing to save in there." Well, that building, if you look at the property tax returns on the Hennepin County like database, those buildings that the bathhouses and the porn stores were in, they're easily each worth $3 to $50 million each business. And gradually, as the 80s and the 90s wore on, through, and I want to really like drive this home, through very specific and intentional policies that the city put in place, they wanted to redevelop downtown to attract wealthy people. And that's what's happened.
When I began this story, I thought it would be a fun, sort of silly story about going out into the woods and trying to find a beach. I didn't think it would become a bummer about how gentrification has and continues to take away spaces from minority groups. There's a positive spin I can put on all this. It's that we don't have to let lost spaces go unreplaced. Even if we can't get that specific place back, we can build new. We can make a new Bear Bottom Beach. For Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher. When it comes to queer radio, Minneapolis has kind of been a trendsetter. Over at KFAI here in the Twin Cities, the program Fresh Fruit has been one of the longest-running queer radio shows in the country. And while here at Radio K, we've never shied away from playing queer artists and songs, coming this fall, we will join KFAI in having a specialty show dedicated to playing and promoting queer artists. Lizzie Ritchie has more.
Hello, you are listening to Real College Podcast. This is Lizzie. I'm sitting down today with Maxwell.
Hi.
So, Maxwell is a fellow DJ at Radio K, and Joe and them are going to be doing a specialty show called Radio K this upcoming fall semester, specifically where they focus on queer artists, both old and new, and near and far. Maxwell is going to be telling us a little bit about what we can expect with the upcoming specialty show and also just chat a little bit about our favorite queer artists.
You don't hear a lot of radio folks in general talk specifically about and centering queer music, and it's such on the rise right now. Like, there's so, it seems like almost every other day there's more and more queer folks like on SoundCloud or other smaller platforms that I think deserve the spotlight, and for one reason or the another don't get that. I hope to have the opportunity to have local queer musicians for an in-studio or just during our specialty show, play a track of theirs, have them talk about their inspiration and influences, and then, go from there.
Maxwell and Joe are the first people to start a specialty show here at Radio K, specifically focusing on queer artists. I think it's super exciting to see the show being created because a lot of LGBTQ artists don't really get the credit that they deserve, especially when they are such a big portion of the indie community. I would honestly even go to the extent to say that they are the backbone of what is propelling this music genre forward. An example of what we talked about was Prince's impact on the local Minneapolis LGBTQ music scene, even though talk of his sexuality was quite elusive.
And I think at the end of the day, like, Prince contributed so much to, like, breaking gender norms and, like, redefining masculinity in his own way, and I think that's absolutely gorgeous. And, like, I think if he was part of our generation, he'd be, like, this genderqueer, like, role model for everybody, and maybe would use language more like that, but for the times, like, definitely had to fit in with mainstream rhetoric. But yeah, Joe and I constantly are like, oh my god, this Prince song is so gay, like, this would be perfect, but I don't know, man. I don't, like,
yeah.
People will either love it or hate that we did that, you know what I mean?
As for artists we can for sure expect to hear, Maxwell and Joe want to stick to artists that are more objectively a part of the community and show that in their music.
At the end of the day, I should play music that it's clear that they are part of the community and not guessing if they are. Because for a lot of these musicians, like, that part of their identity is so personal to them, and it's not something that, like, I'm gonna speak for, but let them speak for it in their music. And if it's such a personal part of yourself, you're going to have it in your art, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't think we're striving to, like, define, like, their sexuality for them by any means. We just want to talk about what they have contributed to the community in music, either historically or contemporarily.
A big thing about their specialty show, Radio Gay, is that they want to make it as inclusive and diverse as they possibly can. But while putting together their list of artists and tracks that they want to play, they have ran into some hurdles that have made this process a little bit more difficult.
I think one other challenge that we, like, have been facing while we were, like, kind of conceptualizing this is that a lot of queer music is, like, explicit and against FCC regulations, and so, like, unless you can find an easily accessible clean version, unfortunately a lot of, like, really brilliant, like, queer people of color who, like swearing is part of their art form, can't be centered in similar ways, and so we're still, like, trying to work around or find the key tracks that they don't say any swear words. But yeah, well, that's always something to keep in mind as well when you're on public radio.
Yeah, all in all, I'm super excited to see what queer artists Maxwell and Joe bring to the local airwaves and to also see this specialty show grow over time. Also, really excited to see them highlight the rich history of LGBTQ artists in the indie community as well. But yeah, this has been Lizzie with Real College Podcast. Maxwell, did you want to say anything before we logged off?
No, thank you so much for having me, Lizzie, and excited for you to tune in next fall. Toodles.
Toodles.
Well, that is all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Thanks to Nathan Fervoy and Lizzie Ritchie. Real College Podcast is produced by Nathan Fervoy, Lizzie Ritchie, Ben Hallam, and Liv Riggins. Alex Schumacher is the host and managing editor for Just This Last Time. And I'm excited to announce that the new managing editor will be Nathan Fervoy, so you can rest assured that you are in great hands. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You should also absolutely leave us a review. It helps more people find the podcast. Thanks for listening.